I start. Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon. Good evening, wherever you are. I have to thank Venerable Anaglio for inviting me to give this first lecture in his class on the Madhyama Agama. And Venerable Anaglio has asked me to speak about the Arahant figure in early Buddhism. I think you all know that the Arahant is regarded as the ideal figure in early Buddhism, the fully liberated individual. But now in this lecture, I'm going to explore different aspects of the Arahant ideal. I'll begin with the etymology of the word Arahant. And here we find different explanations depending upon whether we rely on the classical sources like the suttas and commentaries or on modern philologists. I'm quite sure that the Buddha and the commentators actually understood the proper etymological derivation of the word arahant. But what's commonly done in the suttas is to use what we might call ethical or spiritual derivations of words in order to bring out the spiritual significance of these terms. And so we find in a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, sutta number 39, perhaps the same explanation in other places, that the Buddha explains the word arahat from a word araka, which means far away. And so the text says that he, the arahat, or the monk, is far away from bad, unwholesome qualities, qualities that are defiling, lead to renewed existence, that are troublesome, result in suffering, and which are connected to future birth, old age, and death. In this way, the monk is an arahat. So here the word arahat is being playfully related to the word araka, far away, in order to show that the arhat has removed all of the defilements that bring renewed existence. The Visuddhimagga, which is the kind of cornerstone of the commentarial method, gives several derivations of the word arahat. Just about all of them except the last are playful or ethical. So first we have the same derivation used in the suttas, as you can see on the outline sheet, from arakata, which means because of being far away, one is an arahat. That's because one is far away from all of the defilements. The second playful derivation is from arinam hatata. And you see, I boldface the parts of these two words that are being joined to form the word arahat. And the meaning of this is because of destroying, that's hatata, the enemies, arena. So one is an arahat because one has destroyed the enemies. And the word enemies, the Visuddhimagga explained, signifies the defilements. So again, we have a playful, ethical, or spiritual derivation. The next derivation, again, is playful. It derives the word arahat by joining parts of two words, aranang hatata arahang. The word ara means spokes, and according to Visuddhimagga, this is referring to the spokes of samsara chakra, the wheel of samsara. And then hatata again means destroyed. So a person is called an arahat because he has destroyed the spokes of the beginningless wheel of samsara, the cycle of birth and death. The Visuddhimagga gives another playful derivation, which I didn't list here, but this derives the word arahat from a word raha, which means secret or hidden, and then the negation of that is the prefix a. So, raha means without any secret, without anything hidden. And it explains that one is an arhat because one doesn't have any secret or hidden wrongdoing. Okay, the fourth derivation that I have here is a more correct etymological derivation. And this explains one is an arhat, pachaya dinam arahata. The word pachaya means the requisites, the things that one is offered. For example, the robes, alms food, the dwelling place, medicine. And so because one is worthy of these requisites, one is called an arahat. I'll come back to this derivation just below when I come to the modern etymological derivation. And here I'm referring to the fairly new Dictionary of Pali by the Pali Text Society, which first it gives the meaning of the verb arahati. There is a verb arahati, which means to be worthy of, to deserve, to be entitled to. And then the word arahat really means one who is worthy, one who is deserving, one who is entitled to. In other words, who is entitled to offerings, respect, and veneration. And so the Dictionary of Pali defines the arhat in its quite literal sense, or in its quite Buddhistic sense, as one who has realized or attained nibbana, as one in whom the asavas, or defilements, are destroyed, and one who is no longer liable to rebirth. And so from this, we can draw out, from these various etymological derivations, we can draw out several shades of significance in the word arhat. First and foremost, the arhat is a realizer of nibbana, one who has realized the deathless state right here and now. Then what makes the arhat a realizer of nibbana is that he has destroyed all defilements. And so he is a destroyer of the defilements. Then the arhat, by destroying all defilements, is liberated from the cycle of birth and death. So the arhat is one who is alive, but no longer bound to the round of repeated birth and death. And then there's a sociological dimension in this, in that the arhat is one who is worthy of offerings and veneration. And the sociological dimension comes in because in the Buddha's time in ancient India, there was a class of beings, a class of people, who had stepped out of the rather rigid system of social classes that dominated in India, to become world renouncers. They gave up the household life, they gave up their class status, they gave up all wealth, luxuries, pleasures of the senses, to become renunciants, subsisting on the offerings of others. They would depend on the lay community to provide them with all of the requirements of the material requirements of their day-to-day life, the robes, food, and so forth. And so, from the standpoint of Buddhism, to be truly worthy of these offerings, one has to become an arhat. So the arhat is so called because he is one who truly deserves the offerings, the respect, and veneration that are given by the people who support him. Okay, so these are all explanations of the word arhat. And now we want to delve a little deeper and look at the significance of the word arhat in early Buddhism. And first, I want to point out that the word arhat was not an original coinage of the Buddha. But the word arhat was already being used in India during the Buddha's time by the followers of the various spiritual schools to signify the perfected individual within each of their own systems. All of these, or we could say most of these spiritual sects, had the conception of a type of person who had reached spiritual perfection and who is entitled to respect and veneration, usually because he is one who has completely purified the mind and gained release from the cycle of rebirth. And so the word was in circulation, spreading around amongst the different spiritual sects. Each one would call their own perfected type an arhat. And the Buddha picked up this word and then gave it a more detailed, a deeper and more detailed meaning, which was rooted in his own spiritual system. We can see some examples of this use of the word arhat already in the Nikayas. For example, in Sutta number 91 of the Majjhima Nikaya, there is a Brahmin Brahmayu who hears about the Buddha, who hears the reputation that this sage from the Sakyan clan is an arahat, a fully enlightened one, and so forth. And when he meets the Buddha for the first time, he asks the Buddha a number of questions about perfected, spiritually perfected individuals. And one of these questions is, how is one an arahat? Again, in the Udana collection of short suttas, in the 10th sutta of the first chapter, we meet a figure called Bahiya, who at the time was a non-Buddhist ascetic, who must have had some powerful spiritual experience, and he imagined that he was an arhat. Only later did somebody point out to him that he was not an arhat and not even on the path to arhatship, and then he learned about the Buddha and went to meet the Buddha in order to learn from the Buddha the true path to arhatship. In the Vinaya, the book called the Mahavagga, there is an incident which has a touch of humor to it. When the Buddha goes to stay with a matted hair ascetic named Uruvela Kassapa, and Uruvela Kassapa imagines that he is an arhat, and he allows the Buddha to stay with him, and each time the Buddha performs some kind of feat of psychic power, and whenever the Buddha performs one of these psychic feats, Uruvela Kassapa thinks to himself, this ascetic is very powerful, but he's not an arhat like me. Then he thinks this thought again and again, until one day the Buddha says to him, reading his mind, the Buddha says to him, Kassapa, even though you imagine you're an arhat, you are not one, and not even on the path to arhatship. And when the Buddha says this, then Uruvela Kassapa, instead of getting angry, he bows down to the Buddha and says, please teach me the path. Then the Buddha teaches him, and before long he achieves arhatship. So we see these usages of the word arhat amongst the followers of other sects in the Buddha's time. And the Jains, who were contemporaries with the Buddha, also used the word arhat. And even today, the Jains continue to refer to their saints by the word arhat. They are called jinas, siddhas, perfected ones, and arhats. Okay, within the Buddha's own system, the Buddha was the first of the arhats. And we could see this first in the salutation to the Buddha, where we say, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. That is, we salute the Buddha saying homage to him who is the Blessed One, the Arahat, the fully enlightened one. And then we meet many times in the text the verse of recollection of the Buddha, iti piso bhagava arahang sammasambuddho, etc., etc. And so that one, the blessed one, is an arhat, a fully enlightened one. So the Buddha is not someone different from the arhats, but he is the first to achieve arhatship, and the one who holds up arhatship as the goal for his disciples. And so the question arises, what exactly is the relationship between the Buddha and his arhat disciples? Here we find both aspects of similarity and aspects of difference. First, with respect to the aspect of similarity, we find several passages which are quite almost identical. One occurs in Majjhima Nikaya 108, another in Samyutta Nikaya chapter 22, Sutta 58, where the question is raised, what is the relationship between the Buddha, one who is a fully enlightened Buddha, and a disciple arhat? And the answer is given that the Buddha is one who discovers the path, who finds the path, who fully comprehends the path, who teaches the path, and realizes the goal first. Then his disciples, who are arhats, are those who follow him, who follow the path, and realize the goal under his guidance. So these texts underscore the similarity between the Buddha and the arhat disciples. But then there are some other texts which give more emphasis to the differences between the Buddha and the arhat disciple, even though they are both arhats, but the Buddha has certain unique powers and certain types of knowledge which qualify him to function in the role of the founder of the sasana, the founder of the historical manifestation of Buddhism. In other words, this is spoken of metaphorically as being the one who turns or sets in motion the wheel of Dhamma. And then after the Buddha sets in motion the wheel of Dhamma, then others follow and practice the Dhamma that he makes known and achieve deliverance or liberation under his guidance. And the particular types of knowledge that the Buddha has are usually set out as the 10 Tathagata powers of knowledge and the 4 grounds of self-confidence. Some of these knowledges the advanced arhats also have, but the Buddha has special powers of knowledge that enable him, for example, to understand where all different types of practices lead, to understand the different spiritual faculties in the people who come to him for guidance, to understand how to teach each pupil, each disciple, in the way that will benefit this disciple to the maximum degree. So for this reason, the Buddha is spoken of in the text as the supreme trainer of people to be tamed, as the teacher or the master of devas and human beings. Within the structure of the Buddha's teaching, the state of arhatship is integrated into the Buddha's conception of the path to liberation. And there it comes as the fourth of the 4 stages of liberation. I'm going to deal with this in greater detail below, but just briefly we could say that the 4 stages are distinguished by way of the defilements that are eliminated at each stage and the number of rebirths that remain at each stage. And for the arhat, all defilements have been eliminated so that none remain, even in a subtle or tenuous form, and there are no further rebirths remaining. When we read the Nikayas, we come across a particular formula again and again, which is a way of describing the state of arhatship at length. So what I want to do now is to take this formula and take a look at each of the epithets or descriptive terms which are ascribed to the arahat. So the formula runs, first I'll read it in Pali and then take each term. And invariably the text is speaking about a bhikkhu. So the bhikkhu or monk is arahan kinasavo pusitava kattakaraniyo ohita bharo anupata sadatto parikina bhava samyojino samadhyanya vibhuto. Okay, so now the first of these epithets is kinasava, which means one with asavas destroyed. And this word asava is very, very important in early Buddhism. The word asava is given numerous translations. In my Nikaya translations, I've used the word taints, but here I have to make a confession. I don't really like the word taints very much, but Venerable Nyanamoli used taints, and so I decided to follow him in using taints consistently in the other translations, but I find it to be a bit on the weak side. Another possible rendering is pollutants or contaminants. These are translations which attempt to pull out the applied sense of the word asava. Two other renderings which attempt to be more literal, one is influxes, the other is effluence. The word asava, etymologically, it comes from the verb savati, which means to flow, and the prefix a, which can mean either to flow inwardly, or some take it to mean to flow outwardly. I prefer the meaning of flowing inwardly. And so asava are things that flow within, that flow into the mind, maybe that flow from the deep strata of the mind into active consciousness, and thereby keep one in bondage through a cycle of rebirth. Again, we could take the asavas as these inflowing defilements to be, the way I explain them, as the primordial drives that keep beings bound to the cycle of birth and death. And the sutta texts specify three asavas. One is the asava of sensual desire, craving for pleasure through any of the senses. The asava of existence, bhavasava, the desire to go on existing, the desire for the continuity of life, which keeps one bound to life after life after life. And then there's the asava of ignorance, the dark force of ignorance, which flows up and clouds the mind, so that the mind falls into the grip of the other defilements. The second epithet of the arhat is visuddhiva, which means one who has lived the life. And what is being referred to here is the brahmacharya, the spiritual life. So elsewhere, the arhat is spoken of as bhusitang brahmacharya, one who has lived the spiritual life, and that is the spiritual life of the Noble Eightfold Path. So the Arhat has fully practiced the Eightfold Path of right views, thoughts, speech, action, livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And by doing so, he has acquired two other factors, which make up the 10 factors of the Arhat. This is right knowledge and right liberation. Next, the Arhat is spoken of as Kata Karaniyo. He's one who has done what had to be done, one who has fulfilled the task. And what are the tasks that the Arhat has fulfilled? What is it that had to be done? We find the answer to this in the formulation of the Four Noble Truths, particularly in the Buddha's first discourse, where the Buddha explains that each of the Four Noble Truths implies its own specific tasks. The Noble Truth of suffering, the first truth, is to be fully understood. The truth of the origin of suffering, craving and the defilements, are to be eradicated. The truth of cessation, the cessation of suffering, is to be realized. And the truth of the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, is to be developed or cultivated. So the Arhat is one who has completed each of these four tasks. He's fully understood suffering. He's eradicated craving, the cause of suffering. He's realized Nibbana, the end of suffering. And he's fully developed the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, next, the Arhat is Ohita Baro. He's one who has laid down the burden. The burden is the five clinging aggregates: form, feeling, perception, volitional activities, and consciousness. The Arhat has eradicated craving and clinging, and so even though he still carries the five aggregates around for the rest of his life, but these five aggregates are said to be cut off at the root. Chinamula. They're cut off at the root because the craving that keeps reactivating the five aggregates has been fully eliminated. So that is the burden that the Arhat has laid down. Next, the Arhat is called Anupatta Sadhato, one who has reached his own goal. This is self-explanatory. He's reached the end of suffering. Next, he's said to be Parikina Bhava Sangyojino, one who has utterly destroyed the fetters of existence. And this brings us to the word Sangyojino, which signifies the fetters or bonds that keep us, the mental defilements that keep us in bondage to the cycle of birth and death. And when I mention the word Sangyojana, this gives me a chance to explain where the Arhat fits in to what we might call the soteriological framework of early Buddhism, the scheme of salvation in early Buddhism, which is explained by way of the four stages of realization. And each of these four stages of realization is elaborated by way of the particular fetters that are eliminated at each stage and the number of rebirths that remain. The first stage of realization is called stream entry, whereby one enters the stream of the Dhamma that will carry one to Nibbana. to final liberation. And the one who has entered the stream enterer, does so by eradicating the first of the first three of the ten fetters. This is the view of self, the view that there is some self standing in relation to the five aggregates. He's eradicated doubt, doubt about the Buddha as the enlightened one and about the truth of his teaching. And he's eradicated the fetter of wrongly grasping precepts and observances, grasping the precepts and certain ascetic practices in the belief that they are sufficient to bring liberation. So those are the fetters eradicated by the stream enterer, and by doing so, the stream enterer becomes free from any possibility of rebirth in the lower realms, in the hell realms, the realm of afflicted spirits, or in the animal realm. The stream enterer will still continue to take several more births, at most seven births, but they will all take place in the fortunate realms of existence, that is, either in the human world or in one of the heavenly realms. Okay, as the disciple continues to cultivate the path, at the next stage of realization, one becomes a Sakadagami. This is a once-returner. The once-returner, like the stream enterer, eradicates the first three fetters, though he doesn't eradicate any new fetters. But he weakens the root defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion. And by doing so, he diminishes his prospects of future birth even more, so that he'll have only one more birth as either a human being or a heavenly being, a deva. As the disciple continues to practice, at the third stage, he becomes an anagami, a non-returner. The anagami, in addition to the three fetters, also eradicates the fourth and fifth fetters, the fetters of sensual desire and ill will. And by doing so, the non-returner cuts off all connection to the sensual realm of existence. The non-returner will never again be reborn, even as a human being or in the heavens where sensual desire predominates. Rather, the non-returner will be reborn in certain higher realms, which belong to the form realm, usually in states of existence called the pure abode. And there the non-returner will attain final liberation, or nibbana. But if the disciple continues to practice and can go even further in development, then he'll reach the fourth stage of realization, and that is the stage of arhatship. With this, the disciple cuts off the five higher fetters, that is, the fetter of attachment to the realm of form, attachment to the formless realm, the subtle conceit, I am, the idea that I exist in some way, then a very subtle restlessness, and the very last strata of ignorance. So with arhatship, the arhat has eradicated all the ten fetters, and by doing so is no longer subject to rebirth in any realm of existence. And so this explanation of the removal of the ten fetters leads quite naturally into the sixth epithet of the arhat. He's one who is called Samadanya Vibhuto, one completely liberated through final knowledge. And this description points to two aspects of the Arhat's achievement, which I mentioned above, the two factors additional to the eight path factors, right knowledge and right liberation. Through right knowledge, the Arhat removes all ignorance and brings the full flowering of wisdom, or panya. And then right liberation can be seen as signifying the Arhat's release or freedom from all the other defilements and from any possibility of future birth. Okay, now the question might be raised whether all Arhats are alike, whether they all have exactly the same achievements. And in this, to answer this question, one would say that all Arhats are alike with respect to the eradication of the asavas, to the elimination of the 10 fetters, and so on. But there are certain differences between Arhats with respect to their secondary achievements. The basic distinction that we find in the Nikayas is that between those Arhats who are called Ubhuto Bhagavimutta, which means liberated in both respects, and those who are called Panyavimutta, Arhats liberated by wisdom. We find the classical definition of both types of arhats in Sutta number 70 of the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Kitagiri Sutta. Here the arhat liberated in both respects is explained thus. Here some person contacts with the body and dwells in those liberations that are peaceful and formless, transcending forms, and his pollutants or asavas are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. So this definition states that this type of person can achieve what are known as the formless meditation, or the formless liberation. These would be the four meditations or achievements of the formless realm, the base of infinite space, base of infinite consciousness, base of nothingness, base of neither perception nor non-perception, and also the attainment of the cessation of perception and feeling. So these are all very high achievements along the line of samadhi or concentration. And then through wisdom, this type of person has destroyed the asavas. So this type of arhat is said to be liberated in both respects, in that he's free from all obstructions to the formless meditations, and then he's free, and that is achieved through the power of samadhi or serenity, samatha, and then through panya or wisdom, he's liberated from all defilements and from future samsara. The arhat who's liberated by wisdom, the panya vimutta arhat, doesn't have this mastery over the sphere or domain of samadhi. So this arhat is defined as one who does not contact with the body and dwell in the liberations that are peaceful and formless, transcending forms, but his pollutants or asavas are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. One has to be clear that the arhat liberated by wisdom can have mastered all four of the jhanas. It doesn't mean that this wisdom-liberated arhat does not have jhanas. This type of arhat has or could have the jhanas, and perhaps, this is something I'm uncertain about, perhaps he might even occasionally enter the formless liberations, but he doesn't have this kind of mastery over them so that he could dwell in them with the body. But what's certain is that he normally doesn't dwell in those types of formless meditations, transcending forms, and he's eliminated all of the asavas through wisdom. The commentaries sometimes speak of a type of arhat who is called a dry wisdom arhat, or dry insight arhat, the sukha vipassaka arhat. One doesn't find that arhat mentions expressly in the suttas, but the commentaries include that type of arhat also under the wisdom-liberated arhat. The dry insight arhat is the arhat who doesn't have any jhana attainments. And as I said, one doesn't find that arhat mentioned specifically in the sutta, but according to the commentaries, they fall under the class of wisdom-liberated arhat. Okay, besides this main dichotomy of both ways liberated and wisdom liberated arhats, there are certain other type of arhats mentioned in the Nikayas. One of these is the arhat who possesses the three higher knowledges. We find this type mentioned very often in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is an arhat who possesses the three higher knowledges. One is the recollection of past lives, so this person can recollect perhaps one, perhaps two, perhaps usually is described though as recollecting many past lives, even hundreds and thousands of past lives, even past lives over various aeons of expansion, aeons of contraction. Okay, so this is a very high type of knowledge. The next is the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings, sometimes called the divine eye. So with the divine eye, which is, surpasses human vision, this type of meditator can look out over the world and see beings passing away and taking rebirth, and can understand how beings are reborn in accordance with their karma. They'll be able to see how those who did bad, unwholesome deeds are reborn in states of suffering and have to reap the results of their bad deeds, and those who did good deeds will be reborn in happy states and reap the results of their good deeds. And then the third higher knowledge is the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, which is equivalent to arhatship. Now I should point out, just very briefly, that these first two higher knowledges do not require the attainment of arhatship or even the practice of the Buddha Dharma to attain. It's said that in the Buddha's time, and probably even up to modern times, there have been yogis in India who, through the practice of meditation, can develop very deep samadhi, and through the power of their samadhi, they're able to recollect their own past lives, and also to see how other beings go through the cycle of rebirth, to know what kind of karma they did, or what their rebirth will be in the future based on their present karma. So those are considered mundane types of higher knowledge, which are desirable in certain ways, but not essential to the liberation project. But the essential knowledge is the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas. Okay, now beyond the three higher knowledges, we find another type or another series of higher knowledges spoken of in the suttas, and these come to be called abhinnya, which we might translate as the super knowledges. Okay, this comes, I'll go through these in the order in which they come. One is called the iddhi, or psychic powers. For example, the power to multiply one's body. So instead of being one, one becomes many. Actually, it seems that I have this power right now since I'm sitting here in Carmel, New York, yet I'm right there in Hamburg, Germany, and maybe in different places in the US, Europe, Asia, all at the same time. So we could say that the internet has given us all psychic powers. I have the divine ear is the ability to, well, still remaining within the psychic powers, one can become many. One could walk through walls and mountains. One could fly through the sky. This power we all have, though we have to get an airplane ticket first. To walk on water, to dive into the earth, and so on. These are various psychic powers. Then comes the divine ear, the power to ability to hear sounds at a distance, even other in other realms of existence. Again, this we all have to some extent with the internet. Some of you are in Europe, in America, in other parts of America, in Asia, maybe Africa, you're listening to me now. The power to read the minds of others. And then comes the three higher knowledges that I just explained. The knowledge of past lives, the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings, and the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas. So those are the six higher knowledges that many arhats in the Buddha's time had. And again, the first five don't require the attainment of arhatship. Okay, now the last point that I'm going to bring up in my talk, it's a question which has sometimes been a bit controversial, and that is the question, can a layperson become an arhat? And the basis for this claim, which is put forth, is usually a certain sutta that comes in the Anguttara Nikaya towards the end of the Book of Sixes, where the Buddha says, possessing six qualities, the householder Tapusa, and then he mentions some 20 other householders after this, has reached certainty about the Tathagata and becomes a seer of the deathless, one who lives having realized the deathless. What are these six qualities? Unwavering confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, noble virtuous behavior, noble knowledge, and noble liberation. Possessing these qualities, these householders have reached certainty about the Tathagata and become a seer of the deathless who lives having realized the deathless. So certain scholars take this passage to be evidence that a lay person can become an arhat and can continue to live on as a householder while remaining in arhat. Now, what's a little peculiar about this passage, if you look at the names that are mentioned, you see that among these names are a number of disciples who had passed away while the Buddha was still alive, and the Buddha told his followers where they had been reborn. And so amongst these disciples is Anathapindika, who we know died as a stream enterer and was reborn in the Tusita heaven. Two other disciples, Isidatta and Purana, who had passed away, and when they died, the Buddha said that they died as once returners and were reborn in the Tusita heaven. Certain other disciples who we know were passed away as non-returners, and must have been reborn in the form realm. So we know that when they passed away, they were not arhats, and so the Buddha couldn't have been describing them as arhats in this passage. I should mention also that Venerable Inalio has also brought up this point in a paper that he's published. The name of the paper is The Buddha's Teachings to Lay Disciples. I think he will give you the link to it. So what we know, what we can fathom about this passage, based on these facts, is that these terms are not descriptions of arhatship, but descriptions of a disciple who has become at least a stream enterer. So a stream enterer is one who has unwavering confidence in the three jewels who possesses virtuous behavior. Those are typical descriptions of a stream enterer and higher disciples. The ascription to them of noble knowledge and noble liberation is a bit unusual, but this is explained by the commentary as the noble knowledge and noble liberation of one in training. So it doesn't mean that these disciples have reached arhatship. By achieving stream entry, they gain the eye of Dhamma through which they can see Nibbana, the deathless. They realize Nibbana momentarily, so we could say that they have realized the deathless, but this is not tantamount to arhatship. This doesn't mean that a lay person cannot become an arhat. There are a few cases mentioned in the text of people who are lay people. There are a few cases mentioned in the text of lay people who became arhats. But the important fact is either they became arhats right on the verge of death and passed away very soon after realizing arhatship, or else they achieved arhatship as lay people, and then very soon afterwards they requested ordination and they became monks. For example, in the Vinaya we find the account of the rich householder Yasa, who met the Buddha in a park. He was very distressed. Yasa was very distressed. The Buddha taught the Dhamma to him. He became a stream enterer. Then later, maybe a short while later, the Buddha went on continuing to teach the Dhamma to him, and Yasa became an arhat. And right after realizing arhatship, he requested the going forth and became a monk. Another case mentioned in the commentary is that of the royal consort named Kema, who was the consort of King Bimbisara. The Buddha taught the Dhamma to her. She was still a rich consort, royal consort. She reflected on the Dhamma. She achieved arhatship right on the spot, and then asked the Buddha to ordain her as a bhikkhuni. And the Buddha then sent her to the nuns, and she was ordained as a nun. So it's possible as a lay disciple to become an arhat, but if one becomes an arhat and continues to live, one will just naturally request ordination and become either a monk or a nun. Okay, so this brings my talk to a conclusion. I wish that I could ask for questions, but the situation here doesn't allow that. But I'm sure, or I hope Venerable Inalio will give you that opportunity to ask the questions to him. In any case, I hope that you learned something from this lecture and benefited from it. And I wish you all a very fruitful, enjoyable, and rewarding course with Venerable Inalio. Thank you.